Good evening. A flood of voters, but uncertainty about the elections builds. Anonymous unmasks himself. A killer cop in Arizona. An assault on a pristine forest in Alaska. And New York City has its first woman chief of patrol. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Thursday, October 29th, 2020. North Carolina, yes. Pennsylvania, yes. Wisconsin, no. That's how the Supreme Court has answered questions in recent days about an extended timeline for receiving and counting ballots in those states. In each case, Democrats backed the extensions and Republicans opposed them. All three states have Democratic governors and legislators controlled by the GOP. Elections are largely governed by states, and the rules differ from one state to the next. New Justice Amy Coney Barrett has not taken part in any of these last-minute orders, but could participate going forward. A senior fellow at FairVote and author of two books on democracy and voting is David Daly. He says this is the most unusual election year in his memory.
Unlike any other in American history, at a moment that seems like no other in American history, what we are seeing, I think, is the effect of having 50 different states, all with their own election laws, all of them presenting different possibilities as far as what is allowed with mail-in voting, how those ballots are going to be tabulated, what the deadlines are going to be, do they have to be postmarked, when can they be opened and counted, and all of that is colliding with a federal court system that has become extraordinarily hostile to voting rights over the course of the last decade, and that has only worsened over the course of this year.
What does that tell you about this election? What's going to happen on Tuesday?
What we have to be hopeful for is that the election is decisive on Tuesday. Election administrators have a prayer. They say, "Dear Lord, please let it not be close." And I think a close election, especially a close election, if states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin are determinative, states that do not allow for administrators to begin opening and tabulating ballots until Election Day itself arrives, that is the kind of scenario in which you could see drawn-out, protracted court fights that replicate Bush versus Gore, except you'd be seeing them in more states at the same time. If we can get a result early, if Florida is clear, if other states deliver a clear indication of who wins, that I think would be a far better scenario for American democracy than waiting on those same Midwestern states that tipped the balance in 2016 and watching them head into the courts, because then it's anybody's guess.
Let's say it's worst case scenario and counting is cut off at a certain time.
You've identified a real nightmare scenario. This is a real collision of election law and voting rights fights, all happening in states that Republicans have wildly gerrymandered over the course of this last decade, so that they have retained power in places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Florida, North Carolina, Michigan, even though a majority of voters oftentimes statewide have gone for Democratic candidates. And if this heads into state legislatures, these are all bodies that are controlled by Republicans. And these are controlled by Republicans in states like North Carolina and Wisconsin, where they have shown no compunction in the past in being, you know, part of serious suppression measures, but also in having lame duck sessions that have taken away powers from Democratic governors as soon as they've been elected. It would be a real mess to imagine state legislatures that have been gerrymandered in such a way that Republicans hold a majority of seats, even with a minority of votes. It's a real nightmare scenario. You could conceivably then see dueling slates of electors heading to the Electoral College and having to be determined by Congress. You could imagine all of this ending up in the courts for weeks in November and December. It would be better to avoid.
How is it that the United States democracy, the oldest, strongest democracy in the world, could come to this point, its whole system on its knees?
I don't think that there is any indication as of this moment what the will of the American people is in this election. If you look at the polls, we are looking at a situation in which it appears pretty clear that former Vice President Biden is going to win the national popular vote. The question is whether all of our institutions are going to be able to function properly. This is all of our democratic institutions malfunctioning at once. The courts and the Electoral College, all of these sort of anti-small d democratic institutions have gotten us to this point, and it's a perfect storm of trouble for democracy when this happens. And it's also the culmination of a multi-year project on behalf of the Republican Party that has been focused on packing courts, on gerrymandering districts and state legislatures, and then using those gerrymandered districts and legislatures to pass laws that make it harder for people to vote rather than easier. And then the judges that they have installed enforce those laws. We are in a heap of difficulty, and we are going to be hoping for a decisive result that sort of keeps us away from cataclysm. And then we have to think really seriously about the big picture structural reform we need to make happen so that this never happens again.
David Daley is a senior fellow at Fair Vote and author of two books on democracy and voting rights. And it's finally been confirmed by the leaker himself. Miles Taylor, the former chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security, was the anonymous author of the New York Times op-ed article in 2018 describing President Trump as impetuous, adversarial, petty, and ineffective, setting off a hunt for his identity. Taylor was also the anonymous author of A Warning, a book that described Trump as undisciplined and amoral as a leader. Trump alluded to the leak, denying he knew Taylor, then saying he was fired for incompetence.
And did you see this? This was just revealed. It was just revealed that, you know, anonymous, you know, this anonymous that everybody's been looking for, that law enforcement could have found early if they wanted to, but everybody was looking for anonymous. Turned out to be a low-level staffer, a sleazebag, who's never worked in the White House. Anonymous was a nobody, a disgruntled employee who was quickly removed from his job a long time ago for, they tell me, incompetence. I don't know what for, but they tell me incompetence. You know where he works now? He works at CNN. Can you believe it? Works at CNN. He wrote a phony book. Was just basically, if you heard about Anonymous, it was like somebody that was right next to me. I thought it might have been Hope Hicks, who's right. I thought it might have been Jared. I thought it might have been Mike Lee. I was worried, from the great state of Utah. I was extremely worried about Rand Paul. Maybe it was Rand. This guy's a low-level lowlife that I don't know. I have no idea who he is other than I got to see him a little while ago on television. And I think they threw him out a long time ago. His phony book was just based on fake articles and left-wing outlets. He worked with the fake news New York Times, right? And he's an employee of Google. He works for Google. Isn't that nice? Google. The people that you guys are looking at right now. The whole thing was just one more giant hoax from the Washington swamp and a corrupt special interest group. I'll tell you what. This guy, in my opinion, he should be prosecuted. He should be prosecuted.
And that cheer was Drain the Swamp. Taylor appeared last night on Chris Cuomo's CNN talk show. He explained why he lied to another host, Anderson Cooper, who had asked directly if Taylor was anonymous.
And I'll just give you the blunt truth. When I published A Warning, I said in the book that if asked, I would strenuously deny I was the author. And here's the reason. Because the things I said in that book were ideas that I wanted Donald Trump to challenge on their merits. We have seen over the course of 4 years that Donald Trump's preference is to find personal attacks and distractions to pull people away from criticisms of his record. I wrote that work anonymously to deprive him of that opportunity and to force him to answer the questions on their merits. And I'll tell you what happened, Chris. The end result is the president couldn't. He failed to deny what was in that book. And in fact, to this day, the White House has failed to challenge the narratives that were in that book or the narratives that I've explained in my own name over the past 4 months speaking out against the president. So when asked by Anderson whether I was anonymous during that time period, I said what I was going to do. I temporarily denied it, but I've always said I would ultimately come out under my own name. But that said, I owe Anderson Cooper a beer. I owe him a mea culpa. And the same thing for other reporters who at that time period asked me, are you anonymous? And I said no, because I wanted that work to stand on its own two legs and deprive the president of an opportunity to do one more personal attack to distract from his record. But look, I'm here tonight to say that was me. And I hope people challenge me on those accounts. And I hope the White House looks back at those accounts and looks at them and tries to actually say whether they're true or not.
Whose unflattering account of his time in the Trump White House was published as anonymous. The New York Times published his admission yesterday. And the first of four men charged for violating campaign finance laws in a case implicating President Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, pleaded guilty on two counts today. David Correa, a business partner of Giuliani associate Lev Parnas, admitted he duped investors and made false statements to the Federal Election Commission. The charges against Correa were part of a broader case against Parnas and Igor Fruman, who worked for Giuliani, helping the former mayor dig up dirt on presidential candidate Joe Biden and his son Hunter. Parnas and Fruman face separate charges for allegedly using a shell company to make an illegal $325,000 donation for Trump's reelection. They also charge Correa with scheming to channel donations to United States politicians from a Russian businessman to support a legal marijuana business. And Navajo Nation health officials reported 24 new confirmed cases of COVID-19 and one death. It was the first death from COVID in a week on the reservation, where a shelter-in-place order, mask mandate, daily curfews, and weekend lockdowns remain in effect. 122,240 people have been tested for COVID-19 since the pandemic started. The known death toll is 575. The vast reservation covers parts of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. Meanwhile, in Tucson, Arizona, near the hard-scrabble desert border with Mexico, a police chief claiming to be a reformer has a hidden history in a poor California city nearly 900 miles away. Pacifica Radio's Dennis Bernstein is producer of Flashpoints. He's author of a three-part expose, Fatal Errors, available on the website Who, What, Why, examining Chief Chris Magnus of the Tucson Police Department, police reformer, or cover-up artist.
Tucson is a few minutes away from checkpoints. The activity at the border, the militarization at the border, have opened up the door to all kinds of right-wing actions, vigilantes. We've seen shootings, people's patrols. We have seen really attacks on various tribes that live on both sides of the border. So we've seen a lot of violence. Tucson is sort of a split town. It's 40% Latino, 40% white, and there's a battle in the middle. You've got your police chief here, who is a very interesting guy, who essentially, he leaves Richmond, California, under the cloud of a questionable police killing, and ends up in Tucson. And once again, he's under the cloud of a very questionable police killing, in which he, in both cases, gave the cops a pass. The guy is known as a reformer, Chief Chris Magnus, but clearly the guy has got a problem when it comes to holding cops accountable for in-custody murders. In the case of Tucson, you've got the chief who's tweeting all about how he would never handle a situation like in the case of George Floyd. But at that very moment when he's tweeting along, he's sitting on a body. They have, for 2 months, been covering up a brutal in-custody police killing in Tucson. This is a 12-minute on-camera suffocation. 12-minute on-camera suffocation, really almost impossible to look at. Now, we put it up at Who, What, Why, but I warn people that it is a troubling situation.
Tell people where your article is, its title, and where it's available.
This is a three-part series called Fatal Errors. It's put out by Who, What, Why on the website, and it deals with the way in which the chief handled the killings in both Richmond and Tucson. And in both cases, in Richmond, I have a photograph in the series in which the Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, has come to Richmond to give a special grant to the chief of police. And you've got the father of little Petey Perez, who was gunned down at 23, in the audience holding up a sign, "What about my son?" protesting the chief, who essentially gave the okay to the murder within 6 hours of the killing. This is a sort of a serial offending chief who is busy acting like a reformer, but covering up really vicious police killings in two cities.
Pacifica Radio's Dennis Bernstein is producer of Flashpoints. He's author of a three-part expose, Fatal Errors, available on the website Who, What, Why. As of today, it's legal for logging companies to build roads and cut and remove timber throughout more than 9.3 million acres of forest in Alaska's Tongass National Forest. On Wednesday, the Department of Agriculture posted a notice stripping protections protecting one of the world's largest intact temperate rainforests. The decision reverses protections President Bill Clinton put in place in 2001 and is one of the most sweeping public lands rollbacks Trump has enacted. The new rule makes 200,000 acres of forest, an area nearly as big as New York City, open for clear-cutting old-growth trees. Dominic Della Sala, chief scientist with Earth Island Institute's Wild Heritage Project, says the Tongass is the lungs of North America.
Alaska is kind of this little bubble that still exists in a relatively pristine condition, but it's changing rapidly. I take the long view on this, and when we keep drilling for oil and in the refuge or wanting to drill, and we log the last of the one of the world's remaining pristine temperate rainforests, that's just going to hurt us in the long run. Particularly, Alaska is ground zero for accelerated climate change. It's happening fastest in the north, in the Arctic, in Alaska, than any place on the planet. I mean, every day we read how fast the sea ice is melting and not returning. And the same thing goes for these forests. They're also being logged at a rate that doesn't allow them to provide their benefits in the long run that we need to weather this climate storm that's coming.
Building roads. Why is building roads important?
Alaska is the last frontier, and it's the only place left in the country that hasn't been ravished by this long history, this long arc of development and logging. It's being done subsidized by taxpayer money because it's very expensive to build roads, especially in remote areas. And the Tongass never pencils out their timber sales. So what they do is they float them by congressional appropriations, which means taxpayer dollars that allow the Forest Service to subsidize the timber industry.
What's the benefit? Is there any benefit at all from this?
You know, it's very short-lived, and the timber industry in Alaska has been declining for many years now for a variety of reasons. They're just not competitive. It's costly. They ship it mostly to China and the Pacific Rim countries where it's made into products and then sold in the United States. We're only talking about 100 or so jobs directly involved in the logging in Alaska. Those jobs would be best served by getting out of old growth logging and logging on a much smaller footprint that is coming back to areas that have been previously logged that have now revegetated and are ready to support the timber industry without taking a stick of old growth and without building any new roads.
Right.
It's unfortunate that the Trump administration has pulled the scab off of this old wound of the timber wars around old growth and roadless areas because there's a better way forward on this.
You expect the courts would stop this, but again, with the new people on the court, who knows if that is for sure.
There's strong tribal interest in not being consulted government to government that they should have been because this is affecting the food on their table. You know, they are a subsistence-based economy that depends on the abundant salmon runs and deer for their food. And for me, it's biodiversity. For us, it's the climate. for them, it's food on the table. And that food has been in short supply because the streams are drying up from climate change and the logging that has occurred all over the place, with the exception of roadless areas, has really had an impact on their subsistence values, especially deer populations.
So this affects the indigenous peoples who are already put upon in Canada and the United States by being a second-class status as indigenous people in their own land.
This is a social and climate injustice issue that is going to affect everybody on the planet, because when we log these forests, we put emissions into the atmosphere, and that just makes warming speed up. Plus, the social injustices that continue to happen with the indigenous peoples. And, you know, we already know that the president is the most racist person we've ever seen in high office. And it just continues to just have negative consequences on disadvantaged communities, on people of color, on the indigenous populations. Climate change is a social injustice. It's not just an environmental problem.
We just heard Dominic Della Sala, chief scientist with the Earth Island Institute's Wild Heritage Project. Because of a longstanding federal mandate, the Forest Service often covers loggers' costs, including road building. The subsidy has cost roughly $1.7 billion over the last 40 years. And the New York City Police Department announced the appointment Thursday of Juanita Holmes as its first female chief of patrol to replace Fausto Pichardo, who left earlier this month after only about 8 months on the job. WBAI then reported on the bad blood between Pichardo and de Blasio. NYPD Commissioner Dermot Shea made the introduction.
As you can see, and probably the worst kept secret, to my left is Chief Juanita Holmes. And I am beyond proud and ecstatic for Juanita on a personal level, but also on a professional level, to tell you now that Juanita will be the next and first woman Chief of Patrol for the New York City Police Department. So without further ado, let me introduce the next Chief of Patrol for the New York City Police Department.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you so much. First, I want to thank Commissioner Shea for this privilege to continue to serve the people of New York City as the Chief of Patrol. I'm grateful and humbled to continue serving under his leadership. The NYPD is my family, and as the Commissioner said, literally, I have 16 immediate family members that serve with me in this department, and proud to do so. I also have the family, my NYPD family, which is my inherited family, my chosen family. And I like to thank each and every one of them, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't so for so many of them that shared my vision. I think about we have some of the finest women and men in this department. They love what they do. They love the city, and they're very selfless when doing so. I thank everyone for their hard work, and I look forward to just serving alongside of them. As Chief of Collaborative Policing, and in every role I think I've played in this department, equality, fairness, transparency has always been at the very heart of what I do. And as Chief of Patrol, this is how I will lead every day.
And that is the new Chief of Patrol, Juanita Holmes, the first woman Chief of Patrol for the NYPD. And Mayor Bill de Blasio raised concerns over the uptick of coronavirus infection numbers across the city on Thursday, warning a second wave would lead to serious restrictions. The average number of people testing positive for the virus has spiked to 2.7%. The threshold is 5%. He said that's a very worrisome number. It's literally twice yesterday's number. While the mayor pointed out that the daily report number is not the perfect measure, he said the uptick coupled with the city's seven-day average is enough to raise real concerns. That number is slightly below 2%. He said this is the first time the number has taken a meaningful jump to 1.92%, talking about the seven-day average of coronavirus positivity rates. He said we cannot allow that number to keep growing. De Blasio encouraged people not to travel for the holidays unless it's completely necessary. The mayor said he's particularly concerned about this weekend's Halloween festivities, telling people to stick to outdoor trick-or-treating in small groups. He warned the city will break up large gatherings. De Blasio said, "We have to be very cautious about how we handle the days ahead to not let the disease back in the door." And that's some of the news for Thursday, October 29, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York City. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.